Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And the good martini was also the lead item in Tuesday's Morning Jolt. And Jim, despite all of the public relations efforts of the president and his lieutenants during their testimony on Capitol Hill and the Sunday talk shows and beyond, the American people still don't like the proposed Iranian nuclear deal. 44% do approve it, 52% oppose it, and obviously that's good news. The question is whether it's enough to get some pressure on Democrats to join the Republicans here and get that two-thirds we need.
If you subscribe to the theory that every silver cloud has a dark lining, these numbers aren't as bad as they could be. When you look at the terms of the Iranian deal, this actually seems like opposition is a little lower than we would hope. The good news is the administration has been pretty explicit making this, you know, binary choice. Well, it's either this or it's war, right? Right. You know, either you support this deal or you want war with Iran. In the face of that, you know, fairly heavy-handed propaganda, a majority of the American people are rejecting it. The opinion of Iran remains very negative. And I kind of tied this into another bit of news that CNN finally noticed the tweet from the Ayatollah Khamenei depicting what appears to be President Obama with a gun to his head, in a quote from Khamenei. CNN said, well, there's no it's not clear whether he personally approves of them. If only the czar knew, Greg. Right? Maybe Khamenei didn't mean it. You know, maybe it was just some rogue low-level employees in Cincinnati, or the Iranian equivalent must have been the ones who sent out that. As if this wasn't really what the Iranian regime thinks, which is to say that they think they've got us very much in a compliant position here, that we are weak, that we have to agree to their terms, and that this deal, even though it allowed, technically says they won't pursue a weapon for 10 years with very dubious verification you know, mechanisms, that this changes nothing between Iran and the U.S. They will not, you know, disavow their sponsorship of terrorism. They get a ton of money from this that they can spend any way they like. It's a terrible deal, and the American people still look at Iran as a hostile state. The administration doesn't, and it's going to be really kind of fascinating to see this debate play out in Congress. I don't think these numbers are bad enough to keep 34 Democrats from supporting the president on what he's going to think is his signature foreign policy achievement. But it's good that these numbers aren't, you know, considering how we've seen disappointing polling numbers for so long, it does mean something that a majority of Americans look at this deal the president has touted to the heavens as peace in our time. And the American people just aren't buying that explanation.
Clearly. All right. On to the bad martini now. And this has been playing out for a number of days, depending on where exactly you want to start the story. It could have started weeks ago, but it came to our attention on Friday when Ted Cruz took to the Senate floor and directly accused Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of lying to the Republican conference by saying that he promised there was no deal to add an amendment to the Export-Import Bank to the highway funding bill. And then Mitch McConnell ultimately adds the Export-Import Bank amendment to the highway funding bill, which has cleared the Senate. And now we'll see what happens with the House. And so this has led to a huge fight within the party. The more establishment types, John McCain, Orrin Hatch, absolutely ripping Ted Cruz, A, for airing this in public, and B, for suggesting that absolutely nothing has changed since Harry Reid was the majority leader. And while Cruz did make that point, it's possible that McConnell has stopped some really bad Democratic ideas from getting to the floor that Reid would have let go. But if, in fact, this is what happened, this is a big-time betrayal in terms of the process that McConnell vowed would be so open over time. And, of course, Jim, when you look at the list of promises from Republicans that they made in the midterm elections and then the column next to it, which you could check off accomplishments, the accomplishments column is looking really, really thin right now.
No, and what's interesting is when they do have accomplishments, it's not in areas that unify the Republican Party and the conservative base. And in fact, it's kind of the opposite. And it sounds like the Senate leadership is very wary about adding language to defund Planned Parenthood. I think that's, you know, right now a vehement priority of the base. The third video came out today making them pretty clear that they're saying things like, you know, we want to see how much we can get for it. The per item thing works a little better just because we can see how much we can get out of it. And, you know, after Planned Parenthood insisted that they never, ever think about profits when it comes to selling fetal parts to medical research facilities. Ben Domenech, who writes that other morning newsletter, had, you know, put together this. They said, what's the point of the Republican Party right now? Is it on foreign policy? Because of Corker, they need only 34 votes in the Senate instead of 66 votes in the Senate.
Right.
Is it on economics? Is it on social policy? What do Republicans stand for? And I think Mitch McConnell, you know, who I've previously been a little more favorably disposed towards, needs to make a kind of a clear point here. Like it's not enough to, we passed a transportation bill. Okay. But to conservatives, transportation bills are giant pork-funded spending bills. This doesn't make us feel good. It may be a requirement. We're not going to eliminate the Department of Transportation, you know, next year. At this point, the Senate majority, which, you know, so many Republicans and so many conservatives worked so hard for, isn't really achieving any conservative priorities. And the big theme on the cruise we were on last week was people kind of lamenting and wondering, weren't we supposed to be sending tons of bills to the president's desk and he was going to have to offer a whole bunch of painful vetoes? Do you remember all that talk, Greg?
Oh, absolutely.
We got Keystone Pipeline, and that was about it, right?
Yep.
I mean, you know, I thought the whole idea was to make, you know, drive down Obama's approval rating, drive down the Democrats' approval rating by making him veto one popular conservative priority after another, and it doesn't seem to be doing that. And I'm, you know, if you don't want to do it in, you know, by attaching it to a spending bill, fine, do it as a separate bill, you know. But there's a whole bunch of conservative priorities that are just clogged here. And it just seems very, very strange that McConnell and his team seem to be so just so tone deaf in dealing with this.
Yeah, a couple of other issues. The two big issues I remember them running on, especially towards the end, was making sure the president didn't go rogue on immigration. They lost that fight.
Total surrender on that one.
Yeah, exactly.
The courts are doing more than the Republican Senate, by the way.
Right. And full repeal of Obamacare. And while there was this amendment to the highway bill, they knew it wasn't going to pass. And right now there's a lot of excuses being made about why they shouldn't use reconciliation, which is the only reason it actually passed the Senate in the first place. They're not willing to get their hands dirty as much as the Democrats were to get a lot of bad things done in order to get them reversed.
And yeah, you'd already kind of convinced the base, okay, we're never going to get anything past President Obama because he's going to veto it, but we're going to make him veto. We're already compromised on not getting what we want. Well, we want to put him in the position where he has to publicly, you know, deny us what we want and things that the public want, you know, is supportive of. We feel like we're sold a false bill of goods here. And I don't understand, you know, maybe there's an attitude of, you know, McConnell, well, really he doesn't want to set the stage too much for Republican presidential candidates and things like that. But look, a lot of Republicans are feeling very dispirited right now, whether it's their Rand deal or Supreme Court decisions and things like that. We need, you know, why do you think people are responding to Trump? Why are people responding to Ted Cruz when he calls out McConnell on this sort of stuff? It's because they see a guy who's willing to fight for what they believe in, and they're very much feeling abandoned right now.
Yeah, and Dominic makes a reference to another column that was essentially saying this is why Trump is getting the response, because they're not getting that leadership. And I've referred to this movie, I think, once in the past. It's obviously got a liberal focus. It's The American President, where Michael Douglas is essentially Bill Clinton. Michael J. Fox is one of his assistants, and when the president's poll numbers tank, he gives the president this little lecture.
People want leadership, Mr. President. In the absence of genuine leadership, they'll listen to anyone who steps up to the microphone. They want leadership. They're so thirsty for it, they'll crawl through the desert toward a mirage, and when they discover there's no water, they'll drink the sand.
Jim, look familiar?
I was going to say, just it hurts me to hear Alex P. Keaton saying that to a Democratic president.
Oh, man. All right, on to the crazy martini now, and this is from Politico. And Jim, you'll be shocked to find out that some of Jon Stewart's really clever material, as he tries to mix humor with policy points and basically make Republicans look foolish on a number of issues, came directly from the White House. The president has actually summoned Jon Stewart to Washington on multiple occasions to try and walk him through the finer points of sticky debates, particularly ones where the Democrats aren't doing that well. And lo and behold, those issues tend to end up on The Daily Show. So it's crazy in a couple different ways. It's kind of crazy smart on the president's part, because he knows that The Daily Show is a place where, unfortunately, way too many people get their real news or think they get their real news. And it certainly, in his final days, I think, diminishes the reputation of Stewart, who apparently has just been spoon-fed his material here.
As somebody observed on Twitter earlier today, every royal court needs its court jester. People have always kind of – the phenomenon I think they describe is clown nose on, clown nose off, that Jon Stewart does a comedy show. And, you know, based on the news. And sometimes it's very funny. Sometimes it's not so funny. Somewhere along the line, particularly during the Bush years, there were this wildly overhyped sense of, you know, Jon Stewart is the modern day Walter Cronkite, or he's the most honest. You know, it began as sort of this tongue in cheek thing. Well, he's the most honest man on television and the only one who really, you know.
And what it was you know, the reason regular liberal mainstream media journalists really loved Jon Stewart and started offering those hosannas was because he would come out and say what they were really thinking, right? Mainstream media types would have to kind of, you know, soft pedal their absolute utter disdain for George W. Bush. But Jon Stewart could come out and call him a bleeping moron, yada, yada, yada. Well, and then into the Obama era, Stewart, who's used to being this anti-authority figure during the Bush years, kind of, you know, has to adjust. Still pretty, you know, resolutely Obama. Hits Obama from the left, you know, when basically Obama would sell out. Wasn't doing, you know, was compromising there too much in their eyes. Why isn't he just, you know, bringing about the liberal utopia that our New York City, you know, hipster audience wants to see happen tomorrow? And Stewart, I mean, the fact that he's been meeting with the president is kind of, look, ultimately, he is now a tool. He is a tool of the administration. He is somebody who was not this angry voice speaking for the common man. It was always kind of silly to portray Jon Stewart this way. Now we see just how ridiculous it was and how kind of infuriating it's been to have this, you know, wild overhyping of him as some sort of important news force. He's not supposed to be a news force. You're supposed to watch the news so you understand the satires of the news. They understand, you know, Dana Carvey doing George H.W. Bush isn't as funny if you haven't seen the real George H.W. Bush. And yet somehow we have this whole generation that has been decided that, no, I don't need to know the real news. I'm willing to laugh at the funny stuff and have my views shaped by the funny stuff without actually knowing what's going on. And the idea of Jon Stewart being co-opted as a tool of those in power goes against everything he claims to stand for. And I think it just kind of indicates the gullibility of his audience. So it's kind of a fitting capstone to the Jon Stewart era.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad this happened on the way out. Helps to put things in perspective for sure. So, Jim, good to be back with you. We'll do it again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.